I'm afraid I brought you here under false pretenses. That is, I'm not going to spend too much time underground, and I'm also not. I decided I eliminated the slides that had most of the genetic aspects to it. So you're going to be left with a talk that's going to bring you both above and below ground, and mostly with the physiology. Before I get too carried away, I wanted to acknowledge the people who were both my funding sources and the people who contributed to this work. And one of the real pleasures of our profession is that we get to work with a very international group of people. And as you can notice here, they're scattered around the world. I need not tell this group that, and basically, there are three categories of plant resources that we need to account for. Those categories can be classified as energy, that could be light or carbon, it could be water, it could be nutrients. There's been an enormous amount of work, and we've heard some of the previous presentation talks about the relationship between energy and water. What has received much less attention is the connections between nutrients and energy, and that's going to be the focus today of my talk. What I'm proposing is that the real link between this one that is one reason that's been ignored is a process known as photorespiration. And in fact, this is a process that is changing under the conditions we anticipate will occur in the next coming decades, and as such, it is going to also change the balance between root and shoots. Again, I need not tell this audience much about it, but in my thinking, a simple way of explaining photosynthesis is that it is the conversion of a low-energy carbon and carbon dioxide into a high-energy carbon and carbohydrate. This involves the most prevalent protein on the planet, say that fast, named Rubisco. And Rubisco carboxylates the substrate RUBP in the Calvin-Benson cycle. Now, this process has an evil twin, and that evil twin is photorespiration, where the same substrate and the same enzyme facilitate an oxidation reaction of the substrate and the release, it is thought, of CO2. Now, the balance between these two processes depends on the balance between carbon dioxide and oxygen at the active site of the enzyme. And it's thought under current atmospheric conditions, there's about 3 turns of photosynthesis carbon fixation for every turn of photorespiration. And what is thought that during photorespiration, the amount of energy that is released during that oxidation of a high energy compound, RUBP, releases about 76 kilocalories per mole, more than double the amount of energy it takes to split water. So it's thought that goes up in smoke. That it is a very wasteful process that plants should get rid of if at all costs. Now, I will try to give you an alternative view in a few moments. Any of you who have been awake not only during this talk, but for the last few decades have seen this curve. And this is the Keeling curve showing the rise in carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere for the last 60 years on the observatory at Mauna Loa. And that it has risen much, about 35% during that period of time. Most of you are probably less familiar with this longer view. This is what's happened over the last 24 million years, that carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere have been below current levels for at least 24 million years, and yet photorespiration has persisted. That is, plants don't know about evolution, do they? That is, they have not done nothing to get rid of this wasteful process, though they've been subjected to it for over 24 million years. Now, some people say that they are helping this process along, and in fact, they produced several movies to this effect, that rising CO2 levels would inhibit photorespiration and therefore stimulate plant productivity and plant yields, and therefore make food bountiful. And these movies, the first one is called Greening of the Planet Earth. If you missed that, there's the sequel. And it interviewed many of our colleagues in carbon fixation, where they came out and talked about rising CO2 would enhance plant productivity. And it turned out they were very embarrassed to learn that the producers of that field were the coal-fired power plant industry in the United States, and it turns out to be false. In all the studies that I've been able to find where people have subjected a given ecosystem to high CO2 for a prolonged period of time, what you find is that in the first 2 years, and this is, let me lead you through this, I'll have other graphs along this line, the y-axis here is the change in biomass with CO2 enrichment, where zero means that the ambient CO2 treatment had the same biomass as the elevated CO2 treatment. The upper end of the scale is 100%, and 100% means that the biomass doubled under elevated CO2 in comparison to ambient CO2. So these are seven different ecosystems. You can see that in all cases in the first 2 years, there was a stimulation of biomass accumulation under elevated CO2. But then in the second and third year and subsequent years, that stimulation disappeared. And this is called CO2 acclimation. In one ecosystem, that of in California grassland, Jasper Ridge, the lower line, the brown line, elevated CO2 even inhibited biomass accumulation. So the idea that the rising CO2 is going to be a boon to productivity needs to be reevaluated. And it turns out one reason biomass begins to decline is that plants become protein starved. And here's a study we did that was published in Nature a few years ago, where we looked at the change in protein concentration of major crop plants under elevated CO2, where zero again meant that the ambient CO2 treatment and the elevated treatment had the same protein concentration, where minus 10 meant the elevated treatment had a 10% decline in protein concentration. With all but maybe perhaps soybean, the plants grown in face experiments, free air carbon dioxide enrichment experiments, all showed a major significant decline in protein concentration under the elevated CO2 treatment. So why is this so? There's been several hypotheses forwarded. Let's go through some of them right now. Carbohydrate accumulates within leaves, downregulating rubisco is a major thing that has been forwarded as one of the reasons for this decline in protein concentration under elevated CO2. Turns out to be false. In general, rubisco concentration changes at the same rate as all protein concentrations, and that is they all go down. Nothing more or less for rubisco. Another is that there's dilution through growth, where in fact that carbon increase is not matched by nitrogen uptake and assimilation, and so nitrogen gets diluted within tissues. False. In fact, carbon increase is about half the decline in nitrogen. So say on average carbon increases about 5%, nitrogen increases on average 10%, decreases about 10%. So there is a decline. So it's not dilution through growth. Carbon enrichment to the rhizosphere, like adding sugar as a fertilizer, leads to greater microbial immobilization in the soil and therefore greater nitrogen limitations to plants. False. Indeed, what happens, in fact, nitrate levels in the soils of plants exposed to elevated CO2 tends to increase. We proposed about over two decades ago that CO2 directly inhibited plant nitrogen metabolism, and in fact, every study that has been looked at this specifically has found it to be true. Here's a major meta-analysis in Science, one in Global Change Biology, one in Nature, which affirms that, and there's more appearing on a regular basis, that CO2 inhibition of nitrate, particularly nitrogen and assimilation, explains the results of most of the studies that have looked at this phenomenon. So why are we so misled? So why would we ignore this very important phenomenon? One is 90% of all studies that look at nitrogen in plants talk in terms of total nitrogen. Now, this is sort of like how the science fiction folk that nitrogen is this monolith. And anyone who knows any chemistry knows that the forms of nitrogen are very distinct. In fact, I talk in terms of the two major forms available to plants in the field are ammonium and nitrate, and they are essentially the yin and the yang of chemical compounds. That is, ammonium is available usually in soils at relatively low concentrations, and nitrate concentrations can be seasonally quite high. Ammonium, if it accumulates in plant tissues, becomes toxic. It also, if it accumulates in your tissues, it becomes toxic. Do not live near an ammonia plant. And that's because it decouples pH gradients that are necessary for electron transport, both in mitochondria and chloroplasts. Where nitrate can actually accumulate to high levels without toxic effects within plant tissues. And that's because it can actually even serve as a metabolically benign osmoticant and act as a counterbalance for cations such as potassium. Ammonium is less mobile in the soil because it binds the cation exchange capacity of soils. Nitrate as an anion does not bind to that soil particles in that way, and therefore leaches into groundwater and causes a whole range of problems there. Ammonium is the preferred source of nitrogen for most microorganisms. In fact, most microorganisms will not use nitrate unless they're absolutely desperate for any nitrogen. And that's because the energy content of ammonium is much higher than that of nitrate. In fact, it takes about 8 electrons to convert a nitrate into ammonium. In plants and in most organisms, the assimilation of nitrate into amino acid follows this pathway. That is, we have nitrate converted to nitrite, converted to ammonium, and then into glutamate. Now, in roots, this occurs, the first step occurs in the cytoplasm, and the last two steps occur in plastids. In shoots, it's cytoplasm versus chloroplast. Now, these are very intensive energy reactions. They require a lot of energy for these reactions. The reductant needed is NADPH, NADH in the first step, reduced ferredoxin in the second step, ferredoxin, ATP in the last step. If you put it on ATP equivalents, the first step takes 3 ATPs, the second step 7 ATPs, and the last step 2 ATPs. That's 12 ATPs per nitrate converted into amino acid. To give you some perspective on how energy intensive this is, if we run these reactions in reverse, we get BOOM! So I don't know if you had to turn in your car to get your airbags replaced, but this was an example of this. We had a company that sold very cheap airbags that every auto manufacturer started using that used ammonium nitrate as their propellant, which proved to be unstable and somewhat damaging, particularly if you're in the passenger side of the front seat. I love those recall notices. Do not let anyone else sit in your car. Did you get one of those? How about that? Anyway, so we've looked at this not in cars, but in various plant species, and we've looked from the mighty Arabidopsis plant to the lowly giant redwood tree. And we've used equipment such as depicted here. In the upper left is the lab in a clean day, and there's chambers for Arabidopsis in the upper right, and then giant redwood in the lower left, and 12 wheat plants in the lower right. What we've measured is the balance between carbon dioxide and oxygen fluxes, which proves to be a very good measure of nitrate assimilation, real-time, non-destructive. And we've done this in about 9 different C3 species, and we've looked at that measure of nitrate assimilation versus internal CO2 concentration, shown on the bottom scale, where under ambient CO2, internal CO2 concentration is around 270 micromoles per mole. You can see as you raise the CO2 concentration around the chute, the amount of nitrate assimilation declines to approximately zero. Using different methods to look at the same phenomenon, as shown right here. No label means that the plants were deprived of nitrogen for a brief period of time and then given a pulse of nitrate, and then we looked at the rate at which nitrate was absorbed by the roots and the rate that accumulated in the plant tissue. That gives you a measure of nitrate assimilation. The N14 label were plants that were grown on N15 nitrate. Over 90% of the organic N was N15. We gave it a pulse of N14, and then looked at the rate at N14 organic N production. That gave us another measure of nitrate assimilation. There are three colored bars here, for those of you who are not colorblind, my apologies. The red bars on the left are ambient CO2 and ambient oxygen. The middle blue bars are elevated CO2, ambient oxygen, and the green bars are ambient CO2, low oxygen. Both the elevated CO2 and low oxygen are conditions that inhibit photorespiration. What I'd like you to notice here that both in Arabidopsis and wheat, in both methods, conditions that inhibit photorespiration inhibit nitrate assimilation. No more bangs. Okay. Another way is to just follow growth under plants exposed to subambient, around 300 parts per million, ambient, 400 parts per million, and elevated CO2, 700 parts per million, when nitrate is the sole nitrogen source. This is in loblolly pine and sweet gum. It's the relative growth rate. You can see as exposure to these conditions it continues over time, the treatments under elevated CO2 have the lowest growth. Now, you may consider me a lab rat, and to some extent I am a lab rat, but we looked at this in the field, and this was in conjunction with Bruce Kimball with the FACE experiment, free-air carbon dioxide enrichment experiment conducted in Maricopa, Arizona. The FACE rings were the standpipes where we released CO2 into the field or just plain air into the field are shown there in the upper left. Close-up is on the upper right. And what occurred over two periods, this is for wheat, hexaploid wheat grown in the field. They had measured total nitrogen and found no difference with the elevated and ambient CO2 treatments in the total amount of nitrogen. But when we looked at how much of that nitrogen was unassimilated nitrate, you got a very different answer. That is, under elevated CO2, a greater portion of the nitrogen was unassimilated nitrate, again being consistent with the idea that CO2 enrichment inhibits nitrate assimilation. So the physiological mechanisms that are behind this phenomenon seem to be threefold. I'm only going to focus on the photorespiration aspect of it for obvious reasons. Because as CO2 in the atmosphere rot is increasing, as I showed you with the Keeling curve, this is going to mean that nitrate assimilation in shoots is going to be inhibited. CO2 levels around roots is often many times higher, and that process seems to be less sensitive to CO2 concentration, as would be appropriate for that type of environment. Unfortunately, the number of studies that have actually looked at nitrate assimilation in roots are few and far between. The most comprehensive review of this was last done by Ann Oakes, may she rest in peace, in 1992. And I don't know if you can read it, but that box in the middle says that nitrate reduction in roots may compete with nitrogen processing in shoots, was her conclusion. And that still is true. And as nitrogen processing in shoots is being inhibited by elevated CO2, one would think there would be enhancement and compensation of the processes in roots, that it might be stimulated by elevated CO2. So we've explored that to some extent, and I'm going to focus on this one. I think I can move an arrow. Let's see. Here it is. So just for now, this is wheat and Arabidopsis. The blue bars, the light blue is ambient CO2 under nitrate, elevated CO2 under nitrate. You can see that both the shoot and the root biomass increases in both species under nitrate as a nitrogen source under elevated CO2. That's why the dark blue lines are bigger than the light blue lines. Now, if you look at organic N in those same plants, that the organic N level decreases, and here we have it in wheat, decreases in the shoot, but not the root significantly, both in Arabidopsis and in wheat. So it seems that elevated CO2 has a bigger effect on nitrate assimilation in shoots than in roots, and therefore there is some compensation for the effect on photorespiration. Now, the most detailed study has been done by Renneberg's group, Proust did his thesis on it, spent years looking at the relative extent of shoot versus root nitrate assimilation. And I want to call your attention to this this is in tobacco, and this is looking at the amount of root nitrate assimilation under ambient CO2, which is about 80 micromoles per gram per minute. And looking under elevated CO2, it goes up several orders of magnitude. So, in fact, this idea that plants can compensate for elevated CO2 inhibiting nitrate assimilation in the shoot by increasing their root nitrate assimilation is consistent with the data so far. So, the take-home message in my last minutes are that plants are not stupid. They do not waste 30 to 40% of their carbohydrate in a wasteful cycle known as photorespiration. They use that process to generate reductant to convert nitrate into amino acids. This is necessary because converting nitrate into amino acids requires 30% more energy than using ammonium. And this allows plants to use nitrate as a nitrogen source without any loss of growth instead of using the more reduced forms of nitrogen from the soil. And that gives an advantage because they don't have to compete with microorganisms. So the ecological implications of our results is that if plants are still predominantly dependent on nitrate as a nitrogen source, we can expect protein levels to decline markedly. This affects not only humans and their dependence on plants as a protein source, but the pests that feed on plants are going to be starved for protein and therefore will need to consume more plant matter, and this has been shown that elevated CO2 seems to increase pest problems. And this is true in forests, and the picture in the background is of the decline in forests in the northwest United States, which could be traced to rising CO2 levels, and this may be one of the actual causal factors for this. Species that assimilate nitrate in roots should show an advantage under rising CO2 levels. Plants exposed to non-toxic levels of ammonium should also show stimulation, and elevated CO2 should change species composition. Agricultural implications are that crop yields may not respond to elevated CO2 to the extent people expected. Food security is at risk because protein will decline under elevated CO2. So we need to think about breeding for enhanced root ammonium and nitrate assimilation, and we have a major program working with some of the people in this audience to see if we can select genotypes of, say, for example, wheat that have enhanced ability to tolerate ammonium and to assimilate it and to actually inhibit denitrification in soils. So thank you for your attention. Thank you. Question? In terms of this processes, we think that if plants are more less susceptible to higher levels of ammonium, that it's probably more of a biochemical. Or in fact, there's been shown that plants that have greater assimilatory capacity seem to be less sensitive to ammonium doses. I don't know if architecture per se might have an influence, but do you have any thoughts about that?
Not really, but I wanted your enlightened opinion.
Back at you.
I work for root morphology, so I have the impression that there's not much to
there. Yeah. There's also the idea that morphology may come into play because under elevated CO2, you have more carbohydrate translocated to the roots, and this may stimulate nitrate assimilation there because of that enhanced carbon source for the roots to do those energetically intensive process. That has been a very tricky, some people find it, some people don't. In our hands, we find it's small and inconsistent. Yes. Okay.
Maybe two more questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.